There's this Fincher quote that has absolutely haunted me as I've inched closer and closer to directing my first film. The quote is this: "The fact is, you don't know what directing is until the sun is setting and you've got to get 5 shots and you're only going to get 2. Now, that has been absolutely true as I've directed more and more commercials, shorts, and performance videos. There's almost always a moment in which the entire fate of the project hangs in the balance, and how you make decisions in those moments is the real job. So, as someone who hasn't yet directed a feature, it's easy to idealize making a movie. But it's anything but ideal. It's blood and sweat and tears and bone and marrow. It's real, not some pie-in-the-sky fantasy. So, as I get closer to making my own film, I've found myself wanting to ask so many questions of my friends and directing peers who have managed to run the gauntlet of making their own features. To be honest, they all come back to some version of a core question, which is this: what is the actual reality of directing a movie? How does it feel? What does it look like? So that's what this podcast is about. Notes on directing emerging out of conversations between two directors. Not the film school ideals, not the glorified hindsight, but directing. When you're truly in it. When you're asking yourself why the hell you ever had the audacity to think that you could do this. Welcome to the Process Dispatch. All right, we're back for another episode of The Process Dispatch. It is with my friend, writer-director Ricky Staub. He made a movie called Concrete Cowboy. It came out in 2020. They shot it in 2019. And it's a really, really amazing story. Ricky, again, sensing a recurring theme, Ricky and I worked together when I was DPing. I actually helped him DP a feature-length documentary that hasn't come out yet, but Ricky and I have known each other for years now. We run in quite similar circles. Ricky has an amazing production company called Neighborhood Film Co. And actually, as a DP, I worked with Neighborhood several times on projects. And so got to see how not just Ricky works and Dan Walsner, his writing partner and producing partner, but how Neighborhood works and how they kind of design and implement their projects. Because I think that, you know, a lot of directors, their area of expertise is actually in the directing or the storytelling portion of the film. And a lot of directors struggle with the producing side of things. How do you actually make something? And I think that Ricky and Dan, along with several of their other partners, created and run this production company. It's a very successful commercial company in addition to kind of film and TV projects. And I think kind of being in the Neighborhood orbit is really cool. It's really amazing to see them kind of build and execute and operate a company with such integrity and capability. The company's based in Philadelphia, and Ricky and Dan live in LA and split time between Pennsylvania and California. And so Ricky and Dan and I all have known each other for years now. They gave me some early advice on stages. I actually met Ricky and Dan for the first time in Los Angeles the day before I started filming on The Heights. They were working on a project in California and wanted to meet up and gave me some really great advice just on things to be thinking about as we were kind of making that film and how to transition it into a longer form project. So this conversation is specifically with Ricky talking about Concrete Cowboy and the process by which they brought that film to life. You know, Ricky said something to me very early. He said, you know, they were very intentional from the jump of setting a portion of the profits from all of their commercial projects aside into a pot. And when that pot hit a certain number, they would go off and make a personal film, a personal project, a short film, something that only they wanted to make that had no commercial necessity or reason for existing, just because they didn't want to have to go out and raise money all the time. They wanted to be able to kind of smartly self-finance their own projects so that they were never waiting for somebody's permission to make something. And so out of that process, they made a short film called The Cage that came out in 2017. And that project opened the doors, connected them with, you know, agents and managers and all the producers that ended up kind of helping them make their first feature, which is a story about the Fletcher Street Riders in Philadelphia. You know, Ricky and Dan, I think as well, I learned a lot from them about telling really personal stories and telling stories based on people and places with which you have put in the time. You know, these are not drive-by filmmakers. They lived in the neighborhood that ultimately that they kind of made this film about. And that was really interesting. So that being said, again, this conversation happened way back in 2020. And I know that they have since then continued to quietly be working on a range of projects, a lot of which they can't even talk about. But suffice to say, they're in the mix on some really amazing stuff. I'm really excited to have caught them at this really amazing time where the film was just coming out. They didn't know the reaction to it yet. They didn't know what was going to happen. But, you know, they had made this really amazing thing and are ready to kind of turn their attention to the next thing. So very excited to present my conversation with Ricky Staub as the latest episode of The Process Dispatch. Okay, cool. All right, I'm going to press record here. Okay, cool. All right, recording. So I would say, you know, for me, I don't know the answer to this. Like, I know you had kind of some experiences early in your career PAing on some, you know, some big movies and everything, but I am curious, like, of all the things in the world, like, why filmmaking? What was it about filmmaking that drew you as a potential path for a career? I'm curious just kind of the origin story, basically.
I think, you know, ever since I was little, I've just enjoyed making stories, not even just particularly film related. Like, even just recently, my dad, you know, everyone's doing spring cleaning right now because we're stuck at home. So my dad's finally breaking out all the boxes in the basement, and he just found piles of old short stories I wrote, some for school, some for not. I remember when I wrote my first screenplay when I was 10 years old. I still remember it was called Half Soldiers, about these two kids that get stuck in this military base and have to like save their parents from these evil military people. Yeah. And I mean, I was like always obsessed with movies and stories. And, you know, my aunt was a producer, and so was a couple of my aunts were actually, and they would send me scripts and I would basically emulate what they looked like, even though I didn't know what, you know, INT or EXT met. I was just trying to figure it out. But yeah, I always loved writing, you know, from the earliest time I could get a camera. I think, you know, we used to make these, me and I have a lot of sisters. We used to make a lot of, what are they, like soap operas. We had a soap opera called The Young and the Useless. And I like did it. So it was just like kind of an obsession with telling stories, no matter what they were. Mm. So I don't know. It was just like always kind of in me. It's the only way I can explain it.
And do you feel like that was something that like your family encouraged? I mean, there's a difference between liking stories and then understanding that that's a way that you could actually like that that's something you could do for a living. Like, when did that realization kind of occur to you that you could actually do this for a job and not just play pretend?
Well, it was interesting. So when I was younger, I had this love for that, but it somewhat faded off just in, you know, you grow up or whatever. I started playing sports. And it wasn't until high school, I actually got injured playing football, that one of my friends had me audition for a musical. Mm. And I actually got a part, which was awesome. At our high school, musicals were a much more popular event to be a part of than like other schools, as I've learned. Like we had a more robust theater program than my college that I went to in high school. And so that kind of drew my first like, okay, this is a really cool expression of something I used to love when I was younger. And it was actually my older sister who encouraged me to pursue arts professionally. And she's 10 years older than me, and she paid for me to actually take acting classes after that.
Oh, cool.
And so I lived in Chicago, and I would take the train down after school. And then, yeah, I ended up stopping playing sports just to pursue different type of acting stuff. So that was like kind of my gateway after a little hiatus in my teenage years. And then that was really when I started to see, like in high school, I got paid to do some really crappy commercials and stuff. And I was like, oh, I can make money. So even better. And so I don't know, I just always had in my mind that that was a possibility, I suppose.
What has that process been for you kind of over the years of like discovering what the next step is or what the path forward is? Like, how has that been for you in this process of learning to be a filmmaker?
Yeah. So I think, you know, let's say if we go from that last, like in high school, it was never my intention to be a director, but I think, you know, as I'm listening to you ask the question, what I've realized I've had really strong mentor type people pretty much consistently throughout my life along the way. So I have a really good friend who encourages me to, you know, try out for a musical. I have an amazing sister who I look up to and I admire, and she's taught me so much about life and business and all kinds of things. She tells me to do something, I follow her lead. And then, you know, I start taking these classes. There's an acting coach there. I remember I helped her. I mean, I'm in high school, like put together scenes for a book she was writing. And then she encouraged me to like, you should get an agent. And I was like, okay, I'll listen to that. You know, and then in college, I have so many professors that at that point I loved writing. So I had a professor that made me write a short film for a project. And then he actually paid for it out of his pocket. So
wow.
I think at the time, you know, I don't really know where I'm going, except that I'm just more or less falling in love with the journey along the way. So I'm taking little bites. And I just think after you, if you do that, you look behind and you're like, oh, wow, I've traveled really far. But it wasn't, to me, it wasn't a very like straightforward, I'm going to be a film director one day. That's my ultimate goal. It kept changing, which is actually something that I had to get comfortable with, was changing my quote unquote like identity, that I, you know, no one, maybe some people labeled it me things, but me feeling like, well, I'm an athlete, I can't be an actor, or I'm not a singer, I can't sing, or, you know, now I'm an actor, I'm not a writer, but I love writing, but well, now I'm a writer, now I'm not an actor, like constantly having to be okay that like something didn't work out, which I don't know if that's just my struggle or maybe that's universal, that I feel like once I've told people I do something, it feels like if I don't want to do it anymore, I feel like I'm a quitter or something. It was weird for me to, you know, be, I'm pursuing acting, but no, now I'm pursuing writing. Now I'm pursuing producing. Now I'm pursuing directing. But I just got more comfortable changing my path, being like, I can't live by what I hope people think about me, which for some reason this industry draws the worst out of that insecurity in people. I don't know. It does for me. Maybe I'm just super insecure. I don't know.
No, it does, man. No, it completely does. Yeah. I mean, I do think that that's something that, I mean, dude, look who you're talking to. Like I've,
yeah, you know, I was gonna like, say, maybe you, you're a DP, but then you're like,
yeah,
I call myself a director now. Like, I'm sure there was a transition there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I do think that there is a way I feel internally, or there's a thing that I'm aiming towards, and I don't know how to get there, but I have to call myself the end destination to like psych myself up to go down that path.
Yeah.
I feel like there is the external version of that, which is I'm a DP, I'm a director, I'm a filmmaker, I'm a whatever. And I feel like a lot of people struggle with this. There is a phase in their life in which the thing they want to be doing is not the thing that externally other people would identify them with. You know, especially as people have day jobs earlier in their careers, or, you know, are doing things that, or maybe they haven't even discovered yet. I mean, that was my story. It was like, I just didn't know. I didn't realize that audio for me was learning a portion of filmmaking. I didn't know that at the time.
Yeah.
At the time I was like, I love music and I love sound and I love the way that sound can make me feel, but I don't really want to be like Glenn Johns or something. You know, I don't want to be a producer of music. And I felt really confused by that, you know, that like, but I love music. And so for me, it took me a long time to realize and recognize that all these avenues that I'd been working on, like in fact, did kind of culminate in filmmaking, that I was working on the pieces of filmmaking without understanding that's what it was.
I mean, it's what makes filmmaking so amazing is like, whatever your potpourri of powers is, I just made that up, but like, you know, whatever this like mix, or this mix is that you have, it's like, it can all like create something beautiful. Like I'm not as audio inclined, but I could see that influence in your work.
Right.
You know, like everyone, like for me is like, you know, how did you learn to work with actors? And I was like, I studied theater I also watched really great coaches work with people who were bad actors. Right. I learned some of the best things from people like helping, you know, non-actors pull out performances. Like all those things years ago became ammo for me as a director, but you don't know that in the moment, you know, because it wasn't even my purview that I wanted to be a director. But all these, you know, little paths you're taking are almost gateways to the next thing.
Totally.
You know, as you discover what for your gifting is.
For sure. When was the realization that you wanted to be a director?
Yeah, I don't know if there's like a day exactly, but it was a period of time, I would say, where, again, I was struggling with my identity. This was actually when Neighborhood had actually already started. And at the time, there was nothing that I had directed myself. I was more, for lack of a better term, like a creative director at the company or a producer. And I would help other directors, or I would almost like co-direct. And it was several years into the company where there were just, it was a great thing. We were having a lot of work come in, but there were jobs that certain people didn't want to do, pretty much the less sexier jobs. But as a business owner, I was like, I'm not going to say no to that. I'll start taking steps to being a director myself. And I remember some of the first meetings that I took with agencies where I told people I was a director. And I was like, I'm like in my spirit, I'm like, I'm definitely not a director, but I need to tell them that because I know they want the director to pitch right now. So I'm just going to own it. And then it was a matter of self-learning on the job. Like I couldn't even told you the difference between a wide angle lens and a long lens. Like I was very far away from having like an actual understanding of the craft there. It's something even to this day that I'm challenging myself to get more technically proficient, because it's not something that I'm comfortable with. And for some reason now it's become this intimidation that I'm constantly pushing myself to like understand and know camera. But yeah, and then it was an interesting like evolution of, you know, I started to do some stuff on my own, and I can't remember the year. I think it was 2015, maybe. Well, the year doesn't really matter, but it was very late into the Neighborhood game that I remember I did a project for a nonprofit by myself. I directed it by myself because I was like, okay, they're not really giving us any money, so if this turns out like complete trash, like I don't feel bad about it because they didn't pay us. So
yeah,
we ended up shooting this. I mean, it helped to keep the bar low for me, so like expectations are bad. But we shot this little video for a nonprofit that was going to play at a gala, and I worked with a great DP and like tried to like, okay, I'm going to just go out and, you know, do my thing. And at the gala, there was this executive creative director there from an ad agency we hadn't worked with. And he kind of found me out, and he's like, I heard that you directed that video at the beginning. He's like, yeah. He's like, it was incredible. I'd love to have you come pitch on a project that we're doing. And so anyway, that ended up being, we ended up getting this. It was my first national commercial for Comcast. Oh. And I remember just feeling like, wow, okay. Well, I guess I should call myself a director now because they're going to have me direct this commercial. And even then I was like, I'd never worked with a storyboard artist, which they were requiring. There was just all this, like, it was a whole new world. Working for Comcast was like the quintessential agency client relationship where everything is very, you know, polished and presented. And I think our company's done now like 20 of those types of spots from Comcast. I think I've directed 13 of them.
Wow.
It's crazy.
That's crazy.
But yeah, that guy didn't know that I didn't feel comfortable calling myself a director, but I pushed myself through the fear and made something.
So this is kind of jumping around a little bit, but I'm curious, like for you, what is your risk assessment when you take on a project that's going to push you outside of your comfort zone? Right? Because I know for me at least, I know that like if I'm not a little bit afraid of saying yes to whatever it is that's on the table, then I probably shouldn't be doing it, to be totally honest. So like, what's your kind of matrix for decision making? When is fear instructive and when is fear like something to push past?
Well, I mean, I think fear is always instructive. Just because you're afraid doesn't mean you should push through it, doesn't mean you're gonna push through it. But I think I've become more comfortable like analyzing like what is it that I'm really afraid of. And I think it's a weird thing in my nature where if something is simple, I complicate it. Like a lot of like my producing partner, like Minka, who's a DP I work with a lot, feels like we'll get like a simple project and he's like, you'll figure out how to make it complicated.
Yeah.
And I think what that is in me is like, I know that if I phone it in, the end product will feel like everything else that's already out there. So there's this also like competitive drive that's just in me to want to make whatever I'm doing, whatever version it is that I'm doing, I want to know that I tried to make the best version of it.
Yeah.
Which just in turn then escalates my fear, because then all of a sudden I'm in a realm that is way out of my league. So, because I'm trying to use new tools, or I'm trying to work with new people, or I'm trying to like just try anything new, creates fear because it's not something I've done before. So I think if you get stuck into a pattern of phoning it in, you're just dead in the water in this industry. It's the burden you bear if you come into this industry is you're going to constantly, it's not going to be mechanical like a lot of other people in your life who have jobs that you just get to like, you know, I figured this out. I've been doing this for 5 years. I'm comfortable now. Neighborhood's been around 9 years and I'm so uncomfortable constantly. I've never like settled.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Neighborhood. Like what has Neighborhood taught you? Because when I look at like other director friends of mine, especially the ones who are kind of wanting to do narrative work and are moving into narrative work, very few of them kind of run their own production companies in some capacity or like have created an entity that exists outside of like being essentially like a vanity company for their own work. You know, it's just a shell company for their own projects. Like, I'm very curious how Neighborhood like kind of fits within the ecosystem of you as a director and what you're trying to accomplish as a filmmaker.
Good question. Obviously, I wouldn't suggest other directors or just people in general have their own businesses unless it's something that drives them.
Sure.
It's incredibly difficult, especially, you know, when the world shuts down. All your jobs cancel. You're not like, gosh, I love owning a company right now. This is awesome. But the thing that for me as a director that I appreciate about the art is the business of it. Like, I think that really good directing comes down to being a really strong manager of people. It's part of my DNA, part of our culture, you know, part of our apprenticeship model at the company is I just love cultivating, like learning. I love teams. I love seeing the power of really smart people together. And even when it's not my own work, I mean, a lot of the work on our website is not things I've made.
Yeah.
And it brings me a lot of like joy, especially when people see a piece of work that another director made with our team. And they're like, oh, I just knew that was a Neighborhood project. Like, I love that.
Yeah.
Because I didn't actually make it. But I've, you know, been a part of a great team that's created a culture and a vibe and a look, and just an ecosystem. And, you know, especially now having made a movie, like it felt like a summer camp that I was a part of.
Mm.
And anyone that's ever been to a summer camp, you know, that period of time becomes etched in memories of like what you were like then, what the people were like, what the feeling of it was.
Yeah.
And I think it's really cool to have a company that basically creates these summer camp moments continuously every single year. Like, I can look back on my time at Neighborhood and I have so many different types of seasons with different types of people, particularly with our apprenticeship where, you know, we're hiring adults returning from incarceration who then come into our company. And it's like every year we've, you know, had an extraordinary travel and jobs and experiences with someone who's, you know, maybe a year or two ago was behind bars. Just a crazy, I don't know, feeling in general, just to be able to create a system that creates those experiences for people.
Yeah.
So that's probably a unique piece of just how I'm made. Every director isn't like that, but I do think every director does create an ecosystem on set. When you're shooting, you demand and dictate how people feel, because what's the saying? Shit trickles downhill, but you know, good things also do, you know. Yeah, like totally. Any project I've ever been a part of before I was a director was always dictated by, you know, how is the director leading, how was he or she treating people. That always dictated everyone's mood, everyone's spirit on set, in the office, etc. So Neighborhood, I think, is just a reflection of I enjoy having a team and creating work. And I think there's just business aspirations too. You know, we want to be able to produce like we do with commercials, you know, shorts that we've now done with other directors, moving yep. into movies one day.
Yep.
That we put together, you know, it's just fun.
Totally. I think that's a great way of describing it. I mean, the director's job is to help create the culture of the project and of the set. I had the experience of shooting with you, gosh, a year and a half ago now, I think.
Yeah.
And that, like, even just the week, I was only out with you guys for a week, and I feel like that was a really great experience for me. I can remember what that week was like, you know, and there's lots of projects I don't really remember exactly what it was. It kind of just came and went, you know. And I do think that, you know, being intentional with creating an atmosphere or Or even just being attracted to certain kinds of stories and looking for more meaningful layers in what could be an otherwise relatively simple documentary or other kind of project, commercial project. I feel like even that to me is something that I feel like not every director does, kind of push for something even deeper from a story standpoint. I felt that working with you guys for sure.
That was awesome, man. I mean, that was a good example of, I'd never shot a documentary before, and I knew it was going to be this slice of life, people. And I looked out into the world and I said, who's the best at that? I said, Ryan Booth. I was like, maybe he'll, I can pull his jersey off the wall and he'll come out of retirement. But I asked because I was like, I won this job with an agency for a brand. You know, I had a really strong vision, but I'd never done it. So it's like, how can I mitigate my fear by putting people around me who are the best at it, you know? I also remember that we left the Easy Rig at one of the locations.
We sure did.
Got destroyed. I was like, I told Dave, our producer, I was like, I don't think Booth's ever going to work with us again after that. Like, back, he's going to be in a wheelchair.
No, I think that, you know, camera operating for me has always been like a really, it is literally the point of contact between the pencil and the paper, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and so even if, as I've moved into directing, I feel like I still need to like hold the camera from time to time, just because that has become kind of a formative action for me. And so I think especially working with other directors, like getting to operate camera in a documentary setting is like very invigorating, regardless whether you have an Easy Rig or not, just because it's like, that's literally the moment. Like the moments are happening, like the sparks are flying off of the metal at that moment, you know?
Yeah, man, I agree.
So talk to me about, like, not to compartmentalize, but like, do you feel like that this, I want to direct a long form narrative project, is that an idea that's running in parallel to Neighborhood for a long period of time? How did I don't want to just do these commercials or documentaries or just build this company at the moment. I want to actually also be working on this narrative project. Has that always been there? I'm curious about the origin of that.
Yeah, I mean, ever since I started Neighborhood, it was part of the plan. Myself and my business partner, Dan, have written well before Neighborhood existed. It's like starting in college.
Oh, okay.
And so that, I would say, is my main love and obsession. Like, I think writing is my most favorite treasured piece of this whole process. And so going into Neighborhood, we kept writing. We're incredibly disciplined, militant to a degree about how much we write and our love for it. And it was just an evolution of me realizing I would direct something we wrote that originally wasn't a part of how we saw things. Like, our goal was just, we're going to one day be paid writers. And then at the time be like, and then have Neighborhood. So what really actually going off of that Comcast campaign, again, reaching out to mentors, I started to have this feeling that, you know, we had created some really great work for some really big brands, but I just started to recognize that I didn't believe in my spirit that, like, even if I made the coolest, you know, Nike commercial on the planet, like, I just wasn't convinced that someone was going to let me make a movie because of that.
Yeah.
And then that was more or less affirmed by, you know, industry of mine.
Yeah.
And so The Cage, my short, was birthed out of Dan and I having a conversation like, dude, we've been writing for so long. Like, I need to just know if I could direct one of our things. So we got to do it. And it was really like a proving ground to me to be like, am I good enough to direct movies? So that was like a looming question, because at that point I had gotten really good at directing commercials.
Yeah.
And I didn't know any better because I'd never made a movie, but I'd worked on movies for a long time for a producer. So I saw that it was obviously different than a commercial. There's certainly mechanics to it that are the same, but we're like, okay, you know, we'll save some money and we'll go do this thing. And, you know, is Ricky going to be the director that could hopefully one day make one of the scripts we write? You know, Dan and I, by the time we got to make our first movie, had been writing pretty consistently for almost 15 years.
Wow.
And like writing. So like any competition that was out there, every Sundance Screenwriting Lab we applied to, every single Nickel Fellowship. If there was a way to win something for writing, we tried to do it and we got rejected by all of them.
Wow.
So it's like, you know, it's like, get to a point where you're like, are we just like taking crazy pills, or are we actually good at this? You know, totally. Hopefully that's encouraging.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that. How do you like, so how many screenplays would you say that you two have written together over the years?
I want to say like 10.
Wow. Okay.
And there was one time where Dan and I were writing a script together, and Dan wrote and finished his own script in addition to that, while we both had full-time jobs. Like, when I talk about writing as like militant obsession, it was like,
okay, well,
let's love it.
Yeah, let's dig into that. Like, so what does that actually mean? Like, what's the nuts and bolts, like, kind of expression when you say militant? Like, what comes to mind? What do you mean by that?
We write, well, now we get paid, but then we write as though it's our full-time job and organize our entire life to manifest that. I remember when I was a waiter in Hollywood, I was, you know, waiting tables to make ends meet. And I had this conversation with the guy that was an actor, and he didn't have headshots. He wasn't going on auditions, wasn't doing acting things, but he called himself an actor. And I, kind of in an asshole way, said, "You're not an actor, you're a waiter." And he was like, "Well, you're not a writer." I said, "Yes, I am. I wake up every single day and I write from 9 to 5 and I work at night. So I write. That means I am a writer. Yeah. I'm not a paid writer, but it's very different." I was like, "But you aren't an actor.
Yeah.
You don't act in anything.
Yeah.
You go and you party and you wait tables. That's a very different thing." Mm. You know, Dan and I share a very similar work ethic. So it was like our ethic then actually prepared us to actually be successful because we just were practicing and we just loved it. I think there's like a love to the craft that always drew us in, but we also did have a deep belief that we were good at it. And, you know, that's where you have to, you know, constantly evaluate, like, is the rejection telling me I'm not good at it? Or is the rejection just part of the process because it's insanely competitive?
Ugh, yeah.
You know, like it's hard to know, but yeah. Dan and I in our spirits knew we were good at writing.
Yeah.
You know, in a healthy version of my ego, I feel like I could outwrite anyone. Like, I just feel like it's my strongest weapon, but you have to believe that, like, otherwise, yeah. It's just so hard and debilitating.
No, totally. I mean, I've always kind of said that I feel like that writing is the tip of the spear of all creative expression. It's the purest, like, expression of your point of view, whereas once you get to the movie part, there's so many other people involved. Then it becomes about managing people, setting a tone, creating a direction, and then kind of like trying to get 100 and however many people over the course of the project like pointed in the same direction. That's a very different skill set than sitting down and like purely expressing, this is the idea that I have.
Totally.
Tell me, where do the ideas come for you guys? Like, are you guys kind of like, you read an article, you read a book, you hear somebody say something, or are you literally kind of pulling these things out of thin air and it's an amalgamation of, you know, a bunch of things? Where do you start when you get that feeling of like, this may be something that we should work on?
All of the above, really. Like Dan last week sat me down and it's like, I have this idea for a movie, and he breaks out his laptop. And of course he has like pages of notes. I'm like, when did you like, when, oh, it's been, he's like been a month of like on runs. I've been like having this vision. There's that version. Then there's books. I mean, Concrete Cowboy was based on a book, and in the first year of Neighborhood in 2011, I flagged that book as like, that would be a badass movie, and just like read it, shelved it, and it was there. So it's just all kinds of stuff. Like, movies have come out of painful periods of our life where we're wrestling with like super hard questions, and then we have, you know, a way to answer it via some creative expression in a script. I don't know. I mean, it's hard. There's like the practical things, and then there's just these like random, like I'll be on a run and I'll get an idea. Yeah, I don't know. There's no one way, and I love all of them. An original idea. Adapting books has become a really awesome thing that I enjoy, like working with an author.
What has
That's
that,
all different.
Have you done that before, or are you in the middle of doing that?
Well, we did it for Concrete Cowboy with the book was Ghetto Cowboy. So yeah. That was the first. And then since we've done another one, but talking to the author about, you know, what drew us to the book. And then also, like, that book in particular was also based on a community that we were really close to. Mm. So we're like, you know, we're going to elevate it, not even elevate it, but just involve and invite the community to open the pages of the book with us and say, you know, how do we express this to the screen together?
Do you feel like that's something that you intuitively understood how to do, or you know, is that kind of a craft thing that you've like really had to work on, or Concrete Cowboy in particular? Did you feel like from the jump you understood how this could become that?
The answer to that is comes over time. Years ago, I read a book on like how to adapt a novel into a screenplay, but I couldn't even tell you one. I couldn't tell you the name of the book, who the author is. Maybe there's some things I just instinctually kept, sure. But it was so long ago.
Yeah.
But a lot of what I feel like commercial making helped me learn, doing The Cage helped me learn, is like what we write, how does it get communicated when it's fully like filmed, was a huge learning curve for me as a writer, because I realized we could write our way out of a scene, but if someone went to film it, it would not communicate the same thing on screen. So that we became much more adept to is like, we read the book and there's this really powerful moment, but because the book has different resource than a movie will have, that scene actually is not going to work. So we have to change it, or it has to be molded differently. That was a huge tool that for anyone listening, it's like you only learn, in my opinion, through just experience, like just seeing stuff written and then shot. And then the other thing that changed for me is like stuff I'd written that someone else shoots and realizing like their interpretation of it. And I was like, okay, that wasn't communicated correctly because it's not what I meant. And so as a director, just being able to self-evaluate a script, it's really hard. It's like, I don't even know how to pragmatically qualify what to look for, except to like close your eyes and imagine the scene. And if there are things that are written in the scene that can't be visually explored, there's a problem.
Yeah.
Even as we got ready to shoot Concrete Cowboy, I realized there had been tricks in that script that weren't going to pay off. And we were like weeks out from production. I'm like, shit. I can give a real example. In the movie, there's this scene at like a police stable. And in the description, it describes and says to the reader, this is where they're at. But then when we're shooting it, there's absolutely no indication where they are. And it was my editor who was like, dude, this scene's awesome. But like the audience is going to be so confused because we have no idea where they are. And I'm like, you're at the police stable. It's like, what are you talking about? And I realized looking at the script, I'm like, oh yeah, there it is. Interior police stable, exterior police stable. There's this and this and this. But I was like, I probably needed to shoot like a sign that said, here's where they are.
Yeah, totally.
And so we had to like on another day, we made up a shot and added to the schedule. It's scary to me that I'm still learning and I'm in the process of shooting my first movie and I still am not like quote unquote a master of it.
I mean, I heard this story, I think it was at Masters of Motion one year, the editor of Star Wars, like JJ's editor, the first new one, 8, that basically they had to reshoot an entire sequence 3 separate times because in the edit, the stakes weren't clear of the scene. And so they like had to keep paring it down and like readjusting both the blocking and the dialogue to like make the scene land. And they had the luxury. They basically, what the point of it was, the editor was saying, a lot of you guys working on indie features just beat yourselves to death because you're like, why didn't I should have known to do this, or I could have done that. Or you get into the edit and you're like, oh my God, like the scene isn't working like I thought it was, or whatever. And she was basically saying like, I mean, we were able to do it 3 times because we had the length and the schedule. We had the, you know, the budget to accommodate we're shooting on sets that aren't moving around. You know, when you're in an indie feature and you roll into a location, you're there for 6 hours or whatever. And then you never come back, you know, it's like, of course, you know, there's this, a lot of times when you watch the big movies, you're looking at the second, the third, the fourth draft of something.
You're looking at the second, third, fourth draft of shooting.
Not just the script.
That's crazy. I've worked on those movies as an assistant, and there's budgeted, it's called, you know, so it's not called reshoot, it's called additional photography. Like,
yes,
it's anticipated that once there's a cut,
you realize
you will go shoot more.
Yes.
Which now that I've made a movie, I'm like, wow, isn't that, that's just like a massive parachute. Like, let's just jump out of the plane and shoot shit. And
totally, man.
Yeah, and we'll go back and shoot more. The thing I'm most like happy with on Concrete Cowboy is that, and everyone should do, is just press down and be merciless to the script. Like, make sure that thing, like, you've imagined every frame of it in your mind and it's tight.
Yeah.
Because you get one crack, at least in my experience, at it. You know, there's no additional photography going down.
Yeah, for sure. Did you feel like in the stable of things that you have, no pun intended, is like, was Concrete Cowboy the one? Like, in my mind, I've been talking about stages forever, right? And yet, if another film walked in the door right now, or the thing that I'm writing right now suddenly moved forward, you know, things would get reordered, and maybe I'm not making stages and I'm making something else. Like, what was the kind of fluidity of Concrete Cowboy? And did you always know it was going to be your first feature, I guess?
It wasn't, actually. So it's a good question. We had another movie that pretty much the entire team that was behind that movie came aboard Concrete Cowboy. And the other movie, hopefully we get to make it, but we put our time and energy for almost a year into another project. And then just because of some scheduling conflicts, it just fell apart within days.
Wow.
It was debilitating. Like, I mean, literally shedding tears of like, wow, what a loss.
Yeah.
And in my mind, that had we not simultaneously been writing and building Concrete Cowboy, you know, we would have been dead in the water, which I always give advice to people is like, don't have one project, like know your next few.
Yeah.
And just learn to work on them in tandem, because that happened to us. Like the, you know, the project could still come back and we're still trying to, you know, we want to make it, but there's just so many variables to get a film off the ground, which you're in the middle of and understand.
Totally.
Thankfully, even the team that was going to finance that movie ended up being the same people that financed Concrete Cowboy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this producer, Tucker Tooley. Like, you know, that's my other huge piece of advice is like really try to find producers at every level that believe in your voice. Because I thought, well, crap, here's this chance to work with this world-class producer. And now that that's gone, now it's gone. But thankfully, we had this other project waiting in the wings that was just as much a part of our heart and ethos. And, you know, we got a chance to present that.
What was that feeling for you? Like, as you started moving down and it became clear this was going to be your first feature.
It became clear to me that it was supposed to be my first movie. The other project is incredible. And obviously, Dan and I wrote it and we have equal love for it. But a lot of really special things happened with Concrete Cowboy from, you know, the real community of cowboys that we were partnering with. You know, their stables are currently at risk from being taken from them. So this film became even have a social mission to it, which is even more a part of our neighborhood vibe. So that all of a sudden became really important, you know, and then obviously getting, you know, the first person to draw interest to it was Idris Elba. So right. That was, you we lost the one movie, and within a week, I got word that Idris wanted to talk to me. It's like my spirits shifted really quick. I was like, okay, let's go that way. Yeah, that's the direction we're going. That's going to be my first movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Which didn't obviously guarantee anything just because someone wants to meet and talk with you. But yeah, it just became evident with like some of the other people involved. The producer that I worked for years, Sam Mercer, who was like a mentor to me. He helped me get that project off the ground, was going to, you know, be a producer on it. You know, even going back to Tucker Tooley, the producer who ended up financing it, like he brought in Lee Daniels to co-produce and finance the film, which, I mean, Lee Daniels to me is like one of the most prolific producer directors of our time. So to even have the chance to sit in front of him and talk about this film and what it means to me, and then have him say like, I'm behind you. Like it became really evident to me, okay, this is the project for someone, which I can assume like yourself, like I have dreamed about this opportunity my entire life. And I think what's the scariest moment for me was realizing I had left the potential phase and I was in the, like, this is where it either becomes real or dies forever. And I remember even Sam telling me, he's like, if you get the chance, don't trip out the door. Because if you fuck up the first one, it's a real hard climb or there is no climb. Right. He's like, you don't even have to make an incredible movie. You just have to make a good movie.
The producer I've been working with, Thomas Binsky at Pulse, said he was like, your first movie does not have to be great, but there has to be great moments in it. And I have to finish watching the movie and want to know what you're doing next. I actually found that to be
great advice.
Helpful. Yeah, really helpful advice. I think it takes the pressure off of every single moment leading to, you know, perfection in some way.
Yeah, I mean, someone like yourself, you're going to strive to make it. You're going to strive to win an Oscar, whether you're told to or not.
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
I mean, like, hell yeah, of course. I want to come out the gates and hold up a statue. Like,
sure.
What's a better way for everyone to know what you want to do next?
Right.
Than to do that,
yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
But it was a relief to me, too, to go, like, don't kill yourself if this thing doesn't go on to win every single award out there. Like,
right.
if it's good enough to prove to people that you need to keep working, you've won.
Right.
You know,
right.
One of the like best moments of the whole journey was the first time we actually were flown to Montreal to show the film to Lee and Tucker. So you're about to show the film to a guy that's literally wins Oscars, and then to the people that paid for your movie for the first time. And it was like the most sick I've ever felt, it, like as an artist. I mean, I must have like just bitten every single nail on my hand the whole movie. Like I was just like, are they liking it? Are they laughing? And, you know, there's like five of us in a movie theater. But the feeling afterwards, when I remember like Tucker stood up and he's like, it's a fucking home run. That's like all he said. He's like, I got to go to the bathroom. I'll be right back. It's a fucking home run. And I was just like, oh my God. Okay.
That's incredible, man. I'm really curious to hear about your experience of casting. Obviously, like with your kind of commercial experience, you have run casting sessions before. So this is not a new experience for you, but I'm curious, like, you know, given that you have not just, you know, people like Idris Elba, but like other really amazing people in your cast, I'm curious what your just overall experience of casting at this particular level was on something like this, as opposed to your previous kind of commercial experience.
There's less pressure in commercials. So I think, you know, when we're talking about a casting director or the process, I'm a little less concerned about the process of it. Mm. Like, I know it'll be handled and all that, but something that, again, having been an actor going on auditions, it's terrifying. It's like uncomfortable. It's the worst case scenario where you're like in a room where you can tell people are like not into being there. Whereas like, I remember being like, leaving an audition and going, okay, that was like 40% worse than what I did in my bedroom by myself when I was completely comfortable. So now that I'm a director, I think, okay, I'm not really worried about the Idris Elbas. You know, half our cast in Concrete Cowboy were real people, like real cowboys with speaking roles, you know, number 4 and 5 on the call sheet. And so I want to get reads out of these people. I'm not going to actually put them through a process that gives me 40% of their value or less of their value. So, you know, it's like, do I self-tape down at their house, stables? Like, I got very, you know, there were a couple, you know, actors auditions that were really good that I went and I just like workshopped with them, and I had them come in multiple times to get familiar with the space. And then also, like, when every single person who was auditioning that wasn't being just offered a role, like, which is exhausting on like a 7-8 hour day, but every single person that came in, I was pumped as hell to see them. And I just out the gates was like, I know this is so nerve wracking and crazy, but we're going to make this great for you. And you're going to get a version of this where I'm going to make sure you leave today being like, fucking crushed it.
Yeah.
You know, there is still like, people still have to rise to the challenge and get through their nerves. But to me, it's like, how can I help people just feel like human and welcomed and comfortable? Because to me, that's like half the battle. Is just, you know, for some people, this audition is like something they've been thinking about their whole life. Like, this is their shot. Like, why would I just sit back and be like, all right, go ahead. I mean, you know, it actually is not a benefit to me, because what if I miss out on someone who's incredible? And I also think trusting your casting directors, not thinking that they're just people that like line up the audition. Our casting director on Concrete Cowboy, I feel like she totally understood the movie I was making.
Yeah.
So even when I was like saying, I want this non-actor person who can barely memorize their lines to play this role versus the super famous person that says they'll do it. But like, really, like, she took the time to understand like the tone of the film I wanted to make. And so helped me make wise decisions, and actually went out of her way to get the right type of actor who would be down for being in a mixed cast like that. So
totally, man. Well, and I feel like my experience with casting has been, a lot of times I'll, especially when we kind of get, you know, you get the pictures on the floor and you're kind of like starting to imagine what the cast might be. And I'm, of course, I'm only speaking from commercial experience, but if it's coming down to two different people, I'll ask for the casting director's input. Like, what do you think about this? And especially in the commercial space, I cannot tell you how many times a casting director is like, wow, I don't know if a director has asked me that before. A lot of times the casting directors have relationships with these actors that span sometimes years, you know? And so
Totally. They've
watched their careers develop. They know about the projects that aren't on their reels or resumes that they've taken or worked on. They've seen how they've grown, you know? And a lot of times, like, I've gotten some really invaluable information from casting directors that's ultimately helped me make my decision.
Totally. And you know, casting directors are gatekeepers,
you know,
agents and actors. They know that, you know, like our casting director, Mary, if she's going to go to bat for a certain talent in front of me, and they know that I will listen to her. So that the person is very valuable.
For sure. How do you actually run your sessions when you say you kind of are like trying, you're not just sitting back and reading, like you mean you're literally getting up off your feet and like working with people? Like, I'm curious how is that expression of like trying to draw the best out of somebody work itself out when you are running a session?
There's like two phases to it for me. At first, I'll say three phases. If there's someone really strong that you can get to read with the person, I would advise that. If the like casting director themselves, or they don't have someone, you know, I've done it where I've brought in an actor who I think is incredible, friend of mine, whoever, to actually just read off the person, because it's such like an energy thing. A lot of casting directors have really good, you know, assistants or people that can do it who are also actors.
Yeah.
Just make sure that it's not like I've watched tapes sometimes where I'm like, dude, the person reading with this person is so distractingly bad. Like, it's affecting the performance for me of the actual person auditioning. So try to just like get rid of that. But the second phase is then, you know, the person comes in, I'm really like welcoming, let's do this thing. Even if off the bat, like you can tell that this person in your gut, you're like, it's not the right person. Like, at least give them the dignity to surprise you, or just give them the human dignity to be cared for. That's just my personal opinion.
Yep.
It's like, this is a person who's spent hours preparing, cares about this. They're going to think about it when they leave. Don't be a dick on top of that. So there's that.
Yeah, sure.
There's a lot of times where like, if it's me, then this is just your own gut telling you like, do you feel like there's something more that this person can offer? Or is it that they're just so far away from being able to do this? Then just thank them. You know, that was really great. Appreciate it. Like, really feel like, you know, them, their value. But other times then it depends. Like for me, I've just gotten more accustomed to understanding, okay, where are they falling short? Like, are there, I think one of the biggest problems actors have is they try to nail all the lines. They try to be memorized, or they're just, I can tell because it's something that I used to have a problem with. So I am like so aware of it. Is like, you aren't acting. You're literally just trying to remember the lines. Yeah. So what I'll do is I'll say, okay, no script. I'm just going to improv with you.
Yeah.
Me and you are going to do it. No script. You just say whatever comes out. I just want to feel the person. A lot of times you'll get a whole different performance out of that person. And then doing other different types of exercises to at least, you know, get them a callback.
Yeah.
Because then what you can tell them is, okay, the next time you're here, you need to be like, you got to be off book. But what happens for an actor is they know they got a callback, so that the nerves of like that first audition aren't as prevalent. And this is just from my own experience. You feel a sense of like accomplishment. Like, I got a freaking callback. I just got to go in there and crush now.
Right.
Versus like all the weight of the world of like, this is my one shot against 200 other people. You know, you feel like you've been narrowed down. So it's just trying to, you know, evaluate what is the person's shortcomings in this audition, and how can you, again, get the best out of them? Because like one of our people we cast on Concrete Cowboys, she, you know, sent me an audition from a closet and like reading with someone, and I could barely hear her, but there was like something in her performance, and I like worked on it with her like 3-4 times, and then she had to come in twice and ended up winning the role.
Wow.
But it was like, I kept hunting down that like, I think it's her though. It's in there.
Right.
It's just like, and I remember after the first audition, we did the whole like, we're just going to improv, you're stuck on the lines. And it was just like this incredible audition. But of course, all the producers were like, well, are you going to do that in every single scene when she's in the movie? Like,
yeah,
she has to prove to us that she can like say the words on the page.
Right.
So that's when I told her, I was like, you're going to come back, but next time you got, it needs to be word for word. And she did. She did. Great.
Nice.
It was a lot of work for me. And I just, my advice to people is just, if you're making a movie, it's going to be a lot of work. So don't try to make it less work at any point of the process.
That's interesting. How would you say that expresses itself? Like, let's take that idea and put it into location scouting or some other kind of like preparatory moment in the film. Like, what do you mean by that in that expression?
Well, it's just so easy to say yes and check it off the list. Like, it feels, there's a sense of burden that's released. I mean, even with that casting opportunity, we were literally days away from starting principal, and I hadn't cast this role.
Mm.
And I'm watching a video from a closet, and I have like actresses that are like, you would recognize, who are like waiting there to be offered the role.
Right.
And it was just like, my gut was like, this person is just not going to fit this world. Like any of these girls, like they're so talented, but I had to do the work of like working with this, with, you know, her name's Mercedes, the girl that ended up getting it. I like had to do a bunch of more work. I had to go to two more auditions with her and workshop with her in my office and like give her acting lessons, essentially, like amidst being days away from shooting the first scene of the movie, you know. But, you know, a lot of people watch this movie now and they're like blown away by her performance. I mean, she's one of the best riders in North Philly, grew up at the stables, and she acts her ass off. It's like, what a victory.
Yeah.
You know, like I always equate it to like a Super Bowl win. Like, you know, you can say what you want about Tom Brady, but that guy has been to the Super Bowl 9 times.
Right.
And I don't think he gets there by taking shortcuts.
Mm.
And so it's like, to me, I'm like, this was my Super Bowl. And thankfully I had people like Dan, other producers, even producers like the financiers, like Tucker and Lee, who are like down for me waiting days till I, like, they never took it out of my hands. Like, this is his movie.
Yep.
You know, this is the position he wants to put himself in.
Wow.
You know, we got to trust our leader. and you know, these are guys obviously that have done this way more times than me.
Right.
Which I shows a ton of respect for their own craft as producers. But anyway, it's like, I think you could take that down the line. How many locations, like to me, location scouting is exhausting because it's just like, you're driving, you know, driving around, you're seeing places, you're thinking through everything and every, you know, it's just a lot of work. And when you span it over, you know, our shoot was only 20 days, but you're seeing 20 days worth of location. It's exhausting and you just want to make a decision, but you have to fight the temptation. Not that I think you should be indecisive. Like I know I'm very decisive, but you got to feel good when you make the decision.
Yeah.
That you don't know in your gut that you're like, it'll work. Like if you say to that, that'll work. How many times do you make average decisions? Your movie's going to have averageness all over it.
I think that's the interesting thing about filmmaking, but just as an art form, is that it's, you can't like make a film. All you can do is make hundreds and then thousands and then potentially 10,000s of decisions that layer on top of each other. I think the thing that's fascinating for me is like, even in commercials, which is my primary kind of experience in directing at this point, like by the time you get to set, you have already built the scaffolding for the film. It's not like you just show up and you're like, okay, now we're going to make the thing. It's like, no, you've already been making it, man. You've been making it for a long time before you get before you get to set.
I mean, the movie is made in prep. 100%. Like, totally. I think commercials, especially, maybe you'll disagree with this, I think some of them I made that are more like docu-style, like, you're going to get this athlete for 4 hours, and you're going to go to whatever gym or whatever stadium they're at.
Totally.
They're going to tell you an hour before where to meet them.
Totally.
And you're like, okay, well,
we'll see what happens. Yeah.
You know, we'll see what happens. And you literally, your hands are tied. You're like, all right, we will see what happens. Cause I'm just going to, it's a whole nother bank of skill set, but what's hard in a movie, I mean, I'm sure there are movies like that where it's like, you're going to get what you get, but you have to like have the focus and the fortitude to like build the movie for weeks, you know, months even before. And that is where the actual work is done. That's what was so exhausting to me that I didn't anticipate, is just like how physically and mentally demanding it was from the jump. Not even just being on set. That was exhausting too, but just like the actual mental activity of prep. But then layer on top of that, like you are now standing on the precipice of the moment you've dreamed about your whole life. And like you get it once. According to our two producers, you know, it's like, it's probably true. It, you know,
did it feel like, you know, you had just put on all new, fresh, crispy new clothes, or did you feel like there were familiar aspects to prepping the film? Was the actual experience of prepping this feature, did you feel you settled into a rhythm and you understood how it needed to happen?
For me in particular, thankfully, I had experience working for a producer for almost 5 years on features.
Okay.
So
okay.
My actual introduction into filmmaking essentially was through features. The commercial side came through Neighborhood, where I didn't know that process much. So I was actually able to essentially lean back onto tools and systems I had been like participatory to as an assistant, but they were, you know, production meetings I had seen happen, but now I was the director.
Yes.
And, but I understood the flow and purpose of them. So I guess thankfully those weren't as intimidating to me. Yeah. I could probably go through like a masterclass of, you know, spreadsheets and stuff, but essentially the biggest thing is to, in my opinion, is to be, be very organized with your thoughts and creative and how you communicate them to that different departments. Cause like you said, you know, at these meetings, I'm sitting at the most obnoxiously long conference table, like you see in all the behind the scenes things where it's like every department head and their team. And, you know, you're basically enlisting them to, you know, deliver on different aspects of the creative of the movie. And if you can't communicate your vision effectively, then it's such a waste and just uselessness of time. So just figuring out, you know, which commercials were huge, because I mean, you know, you have to communicate your ideas 10 times to like win the job, to then, you know, be at the agency, then with the creative directors, then to the client, then, you know, sometimes you're not even presenting your own ideas to the client. So you have to have, make sure they're clear enough to creative directors to communicate to the client. And then sometimes even the client has to communicate them, like the marketing team at the actual brand has to communicate that to their bosses. It's like, the levels of telephone.
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
I would say the biggest difference though in features, which you'll probably love, is that like the product you're putting out is your vision. It's not a shoe.
Right.
It's not a brand. Like what is being sold is your ideas and everyone knows that. Yep. So like you are the, in a healthy environment, which I would say mine was healthy, is that like everyone respected that it was my vision for the movie.
Right.
It's nice because like, if I say this, then the goal is for them to understand what I want, not someone two layers above me, you know, like where that can happen in an unhealthy way with commercials where it's like, well, we know what the director wants, but this is what the brand wants, or this is what the CEO wants, or this is what the agency wants. You know, it's like a game of,
yeah, there's a lot of competing, stakeholders, I think is the euphemism.
Stakeholders. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Oh man. It's like, it was interesting. I got the experience of, I got to be on set for Fargo season 4 for a few days of production, back in February. And, I was in Chicago and Dana Gonzalez, who is a really amazing DP who is also directing, was kind enough to invite me to come to set for a couple of days. And the first AD, on maybe halfway through the first day, you know, we were talking on break at one point, and she was just asking about kind of my, you know, directing experience. And I was like, wow, I've just been doing commercials. I haven't kind of gotten into narrative yet. And she's like, oh man, like I first AD commercials all the time. She was like, how has it been so far being here? And I was like, it's really amazing. It looks very similar to like the kind of process and structure of commercials. Like the crew is about the same size. The speed was about the same, you know, like you're not belaboring, you kind of got to keep your foot on the gas. And she was like, yeah, but there's no agency and client. And I was like, yeah, it's kind of amazing. She was like, yeah, it's just like the director, the writer, maybe the showrunner, but really not typically. It's really just the director and the writer, like deciding if they're good. She's like, it's pretty amazing to not have to like radio back to Video Village and be like, are we good to move on? you know?
The thing too is like when you do have people, you know, like you'll have people at Village that have our quote unquote stakeholders. But again, like the product is the story, not, you know, the brand or like we need more can, we need more bottle, like, you know, which essentially is a distraction in a lot of ways to story. Whereas like what is, you know, again, even if there are those people at Village, everyone's trying to fight for like, okay, what's the best way to tell the story? And there are plenty of times for me where, again, I was able to trust these producers, but where we disagreed on something. So I was like, well, let me get it both ways. Like, let me do it my way. Let me do it your way. And I'll communicate it and fight for it the best way possible. And then let the actors do it their way too. You know, like having options in post is, I'm a huge advocate for that.
Totally. Okay. So let's talk about being on set. Was this your first experience like directing essentially famous actors that people all recognize? Have you directed actors at this level before this experience?
No.
Okay. So, so what was that process for you? Is that something that evolved over the course of the shoot? did you feel like you needed to identify what your role was going to be as the kind of director for helping lead some of these performances, like what that experience was like for you?
Yeah, I mean, there's no way around it. It's terrifying. That's just something you will have the chance to step into someday. Yeah, it's just, it's insane. Like, especially when you think of, you know, my first day of shooting was Idris Elba, Caleb McLaughlin, and Jarrell Jerome. You know, and Jarrell just totally won an Emmy. It's like, I was like, okay, let's just. And actually, the first scene we shot was like super, is like Jarrell's super emotional scene. It's just terrifying. Like, you're just going to be sick to your stomach. I don't know how you avoid that reality of that. But I had in my head that like my directing style would change, because I think some people critique it like I'm telling people how to act, because I get really like emotional and into the scenes with them. But when we did the take a few times, I remember thinking like, I just got to get in my bag. Fuck it. Like, this is how I direct. I don't give a shit. Like, I'm going to go in there and get in there and I'm just going to do my thing. But eventually what I started to learn what actors responded to what, and like how much coaching or that kind of emotionalism they needed. You know, it works wonders for non-actors who like, okay, Ricky's being super intense. I guess that's how intense he wants me to be. Like, I'm just going to get intense with him. It became obvious to me why people like, you know, Jarrell, Caleb, and Idris are famous, because they're so talented. Like, they came and did things that I was like, oh my God, like, I'm just standing close so I can witness this shit. Like, you know, like, I didn't even have to like, you know, push you that hard. They just understood it. But there's definitely, the comfort is there. You develop a rhythm and a routine and a comfortability with what you're doing and with who you're doing it with. I was fortunate enough that all the actors were incredibly kind and generous with just their time, their personalities, their craft. Like, I didn't have to deal with any like, you know, crazy stories of crazy actors.
And tell me about like your style. I mean, I've obviously been on set with you in a documentary setting, so I've seen kind of how you've approached certain documentary scenes, or how to kind of how you've adjusted on the fly. Like, talk to me a little bit about your style as a narrative director. When you say, do you, Ricky, like, what did that mean?
The thing that I'm thankful for looking back now that it's finished is I was able to distinguish myself as writer Ricky and then director Ricky. I never held the script as precious, like I was directing Shakespeare. To me, the goal was I needed the best version of this scene, whether or not the words I wrote are the words necessary to achieve it. Was like a big deal to me, because there were a lot of times with non-actors, but also like giving actors the latitude and the freedom to express themselves off the page. We stuck to script a lot of the times. Like, people were like, this is a great script, we want to say these words. But sometimes I would really want to like explore being able to test in my gut, like, this as written doesn't work. Like, for some reason I can close my eyes and imagine the scene in my head as written, and for some reason in my head it works, but I'm sitting here watching take after take and it's not working. So what about it isn't working? And part of my process is asking the actors, like, do you guys feel that way? Do you feel like it's not working? Part of my style is admitting that I don't know everything. Just because I don't know everything doesn't mean I don't have the strongest vision. Giving over time especially becomes more of a weapon. Once these actors started to understand their characters more, they could, you know, live and breathe out of that body more than in the beginning. Jarrell and Caleb were really good at that. So I guess not holding the script as though I'm holding, like, you know, 500-year-old, you know, Shakespeare in my hands. Like, this is, you know, I wrote it, you know, it's going to keep changing. Why not change it now? The beauty, again, I think of filmmaking is like, let's do one as it's written, and then let's do a bunch of others not as it's written, and have all really great versions of this in post.
What happens for you like when something's not working on set?
I go to my like trusted people, which, if it's something that's not working in the scene, it's the actors, it's the DP, or it's Dan. Having a moment of just, you know, again, you have to trust the script. Like, we all got into this because from the get-go, from the base, it was strong. So one of the things we did is, if we ever were doubting ourselves, we stuck to the scene. We're like, okay, right now we could be fatigued. We cannot see it as part of the greater puzzle. It's just like this piece out by itself. Worst case scenario, just trust the scene, like trust that you did. And I could trust that because I know I belabored my shot list. Like I was able to sit down and I could like, you know, we'd go on a drive to a scout like 2 hours away and I'd sit there and my eyes closed and I'd watch the whole movie shot for shot. This is like in prep. So I was like, I know I have belabored what I'm trying to achieve here. So at worst case, let's just shoot the scene. And I think it paid off every time, at least in this movie. But then there's other times where you open this discussion and then the actors will tell you things or like, well, wouldn't it be like this? And it's usually like a light bulb goes off. Like, you're right. That's why it's not working. It's actually not genuine to like their relationship or what is actually going to happen or, you know, and you end up finding these little gems later. Like you'll watch it in post and be like, ooh, remember when that wasn't part of the script and now it's like a huge integral piece.
What for you, like you guys have a great day on set. You wrap for the day, like you go back home. What happens at night? Like, are you thinking about things? Are you watching dailies?
Yeah, I mean, it was incredibly exhausting. I probably should have been watching dailies, which typically I only got to watch them essentially on the weekends. I mean, I would get home oftentimes, you know, my family was already asleep, you know, half the movie we were shooting with horses. So I smelled like shit. So I'd shower. My wife like made me keep all my stuff like outside of the hotel room or like in this like sequestered area. And I would just pass out. I mean, the physical demand of the whole process was completely alarming to me. I had no idea how tired I would be. Trying to get as much mental rest as you can is, I think, vital. It was really the weekends that were like the biggest preparatory time and recharge. If you're shooting any movie that has any health attached to it, you're going to get some level of weekend. Yeah. Like Saturday was usually all resting, being with my family, watching dailies. And then Sunday was basically all day preparing for the week ahead.
I'm asking this because I have a person, this is one of my own personal deficiencies as a director or insecurities as a director, is that I'm like, my biggest fear is not being prepared, basically. And so a lot of times, I think for me, I'm asking the question often, like, what is the best way for me to be prepared for what's about to happen? You know, especially when I'm in a situation in which it's my first time to do something, you know? So I just remember like driving to my very first casting session being like, what is my job today? You know, like, what am I doing? Do you feel like that you knew how to be prepared for a production day on this film?
Yes and no. I mean, I think a good question to ask someone who has more experience than you is, what can I do to be prepared if you don't know? I had the luxury of having very seasoned producers behind me. So it's like, I would ask that question continuously, you know, like, or going to a department, even, you know, like a department head and being like, what's a value right now to you from my brain? Like, what do we need to talk about? Like, what's the way forward here? How can I help you? And they usually know exactly what can help them because ultimately the movie gets made because all your departments hopefully are working effectively. From my experience, having worked for a producer, what happens behind the director's back is everyone grumbles about how they don't know what to do because the director won't give them the time of day. And so what I alleviate, hopefully, is asking, what do you need? Like, what do you need to know? You know, I definitely have a reputation of being very like on the table, straightforward. Like, if I don't like something, I'm not mean about it, but I'll be like, that's not right. I'm also very on the table if something's amazing to me. You know, I make sure to uplift and praise things just as much as I say no to things to make sure everyone knows, like, I'm not just a naysayer. But yeah, then there's, you know, things that, like, my AD is amazing, has done movies for, I don't know, say like 20 years. Me, him, and Minka, my DP, spent every Sunday, we'd go to this place that had like all day brunch and we would get a private little room, start in the morning, eat breakfast, and work all the way through lunch, shot listing, or me walking through my shots for the whole week in the schedule. And Minka would draw up lighting plans so that we never got into a situation where we had to like flip the world and shoot something twice. So sometimes we were shooting erratically out of order, but I always want the movie to look the best it can possibly look. So I will stretch myself or the performances so that the scene looks amazing. Like, there was a couple scenes in the movie we shot, the block that we shot on had a 45-minute window of sun when it was setting that would cut straight down the block. there's a couple scenes that we did the entire scene in that 45 minute window. It was like rapid, boom, 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 boom. But we knew we were like completely ready, prepared, standing by for it. We told the actors this is how it's going to go down. A lot of actors like working like that too, where it's just like a play. They just get to like keep going. But it was only because of the prep that then Minka could then, you know, delineate the plan to G&E. I'm like, you know, this is what we need at exactly this time. No minute short. Be ready for this. Our AD thought we were kind of insane.
I mean, I've kind of feel like if my AD doesn't look at me at some point and say, dude, you're crazy, then I'm not pushing hard enough, you know?
I suspect it's a lot. You're like a lot like I was, where most people said that to me at least once or twice.
Oh, from for every sure, department. Man. For sure.
Like, I remember even our transpo captain, it was being communicated to me that he was like, I signed up because this movie was like a tier one. I thought it was going to be like one location. Like, I'm moving trucks.
All over the city.
Sometimes twice a day. Like, all over the city. Like, how did you guys make this budget work? Like, I don't understand.
Oh,
like,
man.
What do you say? You're packing a lot of shit into this bag.
Right. That's right. Got you, man. For sure. I remember actually being at a Starbucks with you. And you were just saying, like, my biggest kind of feeling about the film at the moment is this a moment that I need to go get the, like, ASC DP to shoot this film, or do I like bring kind of the people that I've been building a process with over the years? Cause I know you and Minka have worked together a bunch. And so I remember you kind of weighing that decision at that time. And I thought that was an interesting, I think, a metaphor for any opportunity of like, where do I stretch myself? You know, and then where do I recognize that like, I've built something that will be incredibly invaluable once I get into an unfamiliar situation. Yeah, I'm curious, like, what your relationship with your DP, you know, with Minka, how you decided to work with him. I know he's obviously incredibly talented, but I'm curious how that relationship evolved on this project.
I've had the hard-earned luxury of owning a business for almost a decade. So I think it's the same decision a director has to make, is if you can see someone's ceiling and you need to go higher than it, then they shouldn't go on the journey with you. I think that is an unpopular decision that I've made multiple times in my life with friends, but I actually think it's unloving to, one, pretend like you don't see it. You could be wrong, you know, but it was my movie, not anyone else's, to win or lose. Like, I didn't feel like I owed anyone anything. Had I brought on people whose I could see their ceiling and it wasn't high enough, they would have just hurt the movie. And so I was like, what benefit is it to them to be a part of a crappy movie? And what benefit is it to me in my career? The people you hire isn't as important as the people you don't hire. Thankfully, I think a lot of why The Cage got me to a position to make a feature, and those are the people I brought with me, is because I was able to work with people whose ceiling is astronomically high. Like, I think Minka, in our time and space as filmmakers, he will win an Oscar as a DP. I'm going to go on record and say, like, whether it's with me or not, I don't know, but his ceiling, like, I can't see it. So he's become so much a part of the fabric of my storytelling that I met with like very famous DPs because of the producers that were involved. And I had the decision in front of me to not work with Minka, but I knew that you know, I was going into battle and I needed someone who was as hungry for it as me. But I also think that Minka is as talented as those other famous DPs. He just hasn't become famous yet. Like, you know, those famous DPs were at one point just, you know, not famous. I don't know. So, but they were given the opportunity. But, you know, I was fortunate enough to bring my production designer and then my composer. And, you know, it was part of, I think, recognizing people that have a high ceiling, but also have the work ethic to like, or the hunger to recognize that this is their chance too. Like, I think about Tim, my production designer, Kevin, the composer, even Minka. It's like, we all had the same thing to gain, which is this is our first movie. Although I think Minka had just shot a movie that went to Sundance. So this is the second movie. But everyone had the same ambition, essentially. Going back to what I said, I think you have to, as much as you are creating, you're also defending your vision. And I think you have to defend your vision from people that are lesser creatives than you. And that might sound awful, but and you don't have to say that to their face ever to anyone, but you know, I always know it in my gut, and this is how I distinguish it, is do I trust the person to be better than me? Am I intimidated by how good they are? And if I'm not, what I end up doing is I micromanage them. That's the first sign to me that I'm like, oh, I just don't trust them. Why don't I trust them? Versus like, you know, a production designer like Tim, I come in and I see stuff he's building or designing, or I like go on a visit to the set and I'm like, oh my God, like this is crazy. Like, you know, that's the feeling you want. Like, you know, when I share images with Minka and then he comes back with like a camera test and, you know, like I remember like, or we made a decision to work with these lenses that were really old. Shit, now I'm like forgetting which lenses they are. Terrible. But anyway, it was like a very ballsy, risky choice. But like Minka had laid out, done all this testing. We made a decision together and ultimately I think it paid huge dividends to the quality of the look in the film. But it was ultimately because he is like a scientist when it comes to light and picture. And had I been doing his job, this movie would look terrible.
No, I think that's really, I mean, I think that's a great way to say it. If it's your job to recognize people's ceilings, you know, and just make sure that people haven't hit them yet. I have plenty of collaborators who I just am like, you have limitless ceiling. You know, like I don't think you'll ever hit the top of it in the course of my entire lifetime of working with you, you know? Yeah, it's miserable when you realize that you've kind of made the wrong choice and are having to do more than just your job.
I don't think like it's the nice thing to do. It's not a form of peacekeeping by like giving someone an opportunity who shouldn't, not even that they don't deserve it. Like,
I think that's something people don't talk about because it is hard to say without sounding like that there's a value judgment in that. But it's in the same way that like you don't cast every actor that you audition for a role. There's some people who they're not ready for that opportunity. There's some people who are incredibly talented who are not the right fit for that opportunity. You know, I mean, like there's a lot of different ways to not choose somebody for something, because ultimately like a lot more people are going to be considered than are going to actually get whatever job it is.
Totally.
And so I think that that's like, people don't talk a lot about not choosing people. They just talk about the people they chose, you know?
Totally. And there's a reality that I've not been chosen in Passover for lots of the same reasons.
Lots of
and
stuff,
that's like,
yeah.
You just got to know. That's just how it is, you know, but if you're in a position to make a movie, that's part of your process is to.
Totally. All right. I'd love to talk about post-production in the sense of you read this book 10 years ago and were like, this would be interesting. Then this thing has gone on this long, circuitous journey of you writing, adapting, writing, then realizing you're actually going to make the thing and having to, you know, transition the script from a hypothetical script to like, oh God, we're making this movie. Then it goes all the way through the gauntlet of production. And you got a bunch of clips on a hard drive and you start to see the film for the first time. Is that a like, holy shit, I can't believe this? What I'm trying to get at is there's the like expectation of how things are going to go, especially with your first film. You've been dreaming of it forever. How was that transition for you of realizing like this is your movie?
I had a mixed feeling. Like I was like, I know we shot some amazing stuff. And I also know that I think we shot some not so amazing stuff. You know, we shot the whole movie in 20 days with very little rest. So I feel like I just collapsed by the end of it. Like, oh my God, I can't even imagine what is on that hard drive. And then there was like the phase of Dan and I watched every single minute, second of footage, just straight through. And I had my own editing station that was linked to the other editor, so I could mark up moments I liked and leave a note like, wow, I really like this for this reason. So they just had an entire like library of my thoughts that was really helpful once we got into cutting. And then it was just like, it was a slow realization that the movie I thought I made was totally different than the movie I made. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah,
like,
man.
It just took on its own life form. I don't even know how to describe. Like, it feels weird. I'm like, I guess I made that. It wasn't always my intention. Like, some scenes are exactly like I imagined. Many of them are not. But what surprised me the most was how malleable the story still was in post. I was so blown away by our editors. They would like show me cuts of scenes and I'd be like, how did you make it? How did you make me feel that way? But like, that's not how I shot it. It's like crazy to me. And it was awesome. Like, it was just like my whole mind. It was like the Matrix to me. I was like, oh my God, there's like a whole nother level of storytelling that's still possible now. I think that's probably more of a tribute to Luke and Megan having done this for so long that they had seen all the ways that the edit can impact how you feel things. Like we restructured the entire movie in post. I moved massive scenes around to the point where I can't even remember how it was written, which is astonishing to me. For someone who is like, I'm like biblical when it comes to structure and making sure your script is tight. But I honestly think because the script was so tight and structured, it was somehow possible to do such a thing. But the power of like, if you just moved a scene here and there, and you know, it's something I learned from Luke and Megan that it's not normal. Like, the director is normally really precious about like seeing it exactly this way. The fact that I was like honoring and open to variations to scenes was something that I think created a lot of really healthy constructive criticism. Probably one of the harder moments for me is to be like criticized for a scene not working, because I'm sitting there with two people who weren't a part of shooting it. I'm like, well, shit, whose fault is this? not your guys' fault.
Yeah. Like, I wrote it and I directed it. Yeah.
And in this scene, I also operated it.
Yeah.
And it's the shittiest scene in the movie.
That's right.
So I felt like I didn't anticipate that feeling of insecurity, but I ended up starting to feel really safe with those people. And, you know, thankfully, even our producers, you know, gave us the time. I don't know, however it ended up being like 10 weeks to put together my cut. I never felt like I had a gun to my head, like, you have to make this change or put this scene in or do this or that. Like, it was very collaborative and healthy.
A two-part question. Do you feel like that's something that would not necessarily happen on your second feature? Or is that something that, like, you recognize as a possibility and therefore gives you more freedom in the writing and then production phase, knowing that you can kind of, you know, push things around?
Yeah, I mean, I think it gives me more confidence in the process. I wouldn't probably prep any other way, just because like Luke and Megan told me, they're like, being able to like reorder things like this is what editing is. You're just not aware of it. But the difference, though, they told me, is that it takes sometimes months for directors to like convince them that like this is necessary. Whereas I think something that was an advantage to us is we pressed down on the story from the jump. So like before we even showed that cut to like our financiers and producers, I had already cut scenes. I'd already made like decisions versus waiting for like a test audience to just bash the movie and realize what you already knew in your gut.
Do you feel like that your gut reaction, the voice that tells you to edit a scene out of the script, the voice that says this isn't working in production, and the voice that says we're going to need to lose this scene while you're in editorial, that through line, that director voice, like, do you feel more confident in one of those phases than another phase? Or do you feel like on this film in particular, did you feel kind of equipped to listen to that voice throughout the entire process? Or if it felt like it was harder in editorial or harder on set or harder when writing, to kind of trust the small voice that's like leading you down the path?
I think it's definitely hard always. I think I'm just better at it in writing because I've done it more. I was also wrong. Like, there were scenes that we cut, I remember, that now are back in it, that it's like hard for me to imagine that we had cut. But it was actually all of us collectively listening to Tucker or Jeff and Jen, our other producers, like a couple scenes I think about that they fought tooth and nail for me not to cut. It was an interesting lesson I learned, is that I got convinced that making the movie shorter was going to give me a better audience score. And I realized that making the movie tighter in terms of like its fluidity of like keeping the audience engaged in the right ways is what makes it feel faster to people. Because if you ever do these audience screenings, you'll get obsessed with numbers and like how short it is and all these crazy things. But we ended up, the highest score we ever got was a longer version than our previous highest score, but it's because we rearranged some of those scenes that were fought for and it just flowed better.
I mean, I've always felt like there's perceived runtime and then there's actual runtime. you know, and people only watch the film like scene by scene. They watch it in like 2 to 3 minute chunks, basically. So like, if you've got their attention for 3 to 4 minutes, like the clock resets and it's like, you've got another, if you can keep their attention another 3, 4, 5, 6 minutes, then it resets again. And like, they don't care if it's 2 hours long. It just needs to be that you've got a firm hand on the 5 minutes that they're watching right now.
Totally. You got to keep them engaged. That's to me, like the biggest differential between commercials and features is like, you can trick someone for a minute to be engaged, but like yeah. for 2 hours, I'm like, if you ain't telling a story, like, I don't care how cool it looks.
Well, which I love that so much about features, because it is in fact just telling a story, and the visual side of things is a component of telling the story, of course. However, can you keep my attention telling a story? Can you tell me a story? You know. So my last question is, what is your emotional state when you think of this project right now? I can imagine that your release, you know, plan for this film has been thrown into a blender and who knows what's going to happen. But just for you as the director, like, do you feel like you've summited a mountain? Do you feel like if somebody came to you right now and said, hey, we're going to go make another movie, would you gleefully say yes? You know what I mean? Like, I'm just curious, like, what the kind of net result of this experience has been for you.
Yeah, I mean, had you asked me that question, you know, 2 weeks into shooting, I would have like hesitated greatly whether I could do it again.
Yeah.
I honestly, I remember standing in the middle of our hotel room with my wife, and it was just like some of the hardest times. She was also pregnant at the time we had found out, so she was like sick, and I was just non-existent. And I was just saying to her, like, I honestly, this isn't me being dramatic, I don't know if I can ever do this again. It was that hard. I was just like so tired. Not to scare people, but it's just, maybe you'll feel comforted. But yeah, I would do it again. It's like a insanity, but yeah, I would. And I feel like it wouldn't be as hard. You know, the first time is just hard because you're doing everything the first time. You know, and emotionally, I feel obviously disappointed that the film is, you know, putting a blender is a great way. We're kind of like, I'm thankful that I finished it. We have a finished movie. So there's that. The biggest hurdle for me is just patience. Like, we have to wait now to unveil it, and the traditional ways in which it would have been unveiled are probably not going to get the fancy premiere with all the people like we wanted. I don't know what, you know, a year from now will look like. But I also try to, you know, prayerfully like reflect on just the gratitude that I have that I got to make a movie. You know, for sure, had this happened last year at this time, I would have never gotten to make a movie. So I try to just treasure at least the feeling of like, I got to do it. And the people that have seen it have responded to it. We've done enough test audience screenings for me to know that I don't think it's possible to make a perfect movie. And so I've already conditioned myself to like, listen to, it's going to sound strange, but when you do test audiences, you really like lean into the critique to try to make it stronger. But the last, like, I think I can't remember last, like preview we did, it got all the glowing, beautiful scores too. And then I made a decision to not read any of the negative stuff because the movie has done. And so I realized that if I can't make any changes, if I can't make it, you know, if I can't do anything with people's criticism, what value is there to hear someone moan about my art? But it is a bummer because literally everyone in this 3-year process told me the best part of finishing a good movie is releasing it. And that literally, like within a week of finishing it, got halted. I was like, son of a bitch.
Yeah, totally, man.
I was like, the best part? Like, what the hell?
Oh, man, for sure. You know, as painful as the lesson is, it's probably a helpful reminder that like, once you've made the film, you know, the part of it coming out and how people respond and where it goes and all of that kind of stuff is, you know, ultimately largely out of your control. You know, painful as this is a good reminder of just how little control we have or what our job is and like what are the things that we're supposed to do and how do we kind of like what our responsibility is in terms of, you know, bringing these things to life and what happens next, you know.
It is. I mean, this standstill, world is in has taught us a lot of lessons. I hope that people carry into the future that, like, we don't control as much as we thought, and however you process that is important.
For sure. Awesome. Well, dude, I'm excited for you, man. And I think, you know, I absolutely kind of look up to you as somebody, you know, further down the path but you know, I feel a great deal of kinship with how you've kind of approached and spent these last 15 years kind of building to this moment, for sure. So, thanks for talking about it, for sure, man.
Yeah, of course. I hope, I don't know. I'm a big advocate for teaching and mentoring. You know, my journey is only possible because of people that took the time to invest in my voice. So
for sure, man.
That's great, dude.
All right, buddy.
Appreciate the chat, man.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll catch up soon.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right, talk to you later.
All right, see you, bud.
Thanks for listening to The Process Dispatch, a conversation about directing between directors. Original music, mix, and editing by Jake McMullen. Produced by myself and Anna Ramos. Designed by Tyler Swanner, and episode artwork by Sean Bay. Please follow us on all social platforms at The Process Dispatch. For show notes and further information, visit theprocessdispatch.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.